Welcome to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio, sponsored by EarthX, the world's largest environmental experience, and also sponsored by Natural Awakenings magazine. Live your healthiest life on a healthier planet. Now here's your host, Bernice Butler.
Welcome to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio today. We are now in our fifth season, and we are more excited than ever to help you explore and understand that unbreakable relationship between your health and the health of the planet. Here we look at the hottest topics related to our environment and its sustainability and how they affect your health and wellness. Here are issues like climate change, plastic pollution, extreme weather events, and others will meet up with everyday impacts like allergies and asthma, digestive issues and gut health, cancers, lung, heart issues, and more. So listen in today as we interview experts for today's show on energy production and consumption, which we've been talking about all month. Now, we're going to look specifically or focus in on the impact of climate change on energy security and human rights. And this is our last show in our series on energy production and consumption. And we wanted to unpack this subject because it tends to kind of bring everything together, but focusing in on the human terms of human impacts. And so today we're going to look at navigating the nexus of climate change, energy security, and human rights. Now, in the hustle and bustle of our everyday lives, it's very easy to overlook the intricate web connecting our energy consumption, production, climate change, and the fundamental human rights that we often take for granted. But today, we're going to look to unravel this story of how all these elements interact, influencing not just the environment, but our health, and even more so, our very way of life. So at the heart of this tale lies the dual challenge of energy production and energy consumption. Our insatiable demand for energy, largely fueled by conventional sources like coal and oil, has set in motion a series of events that now threaten the delicate balance of our planet. As temperatures rise and extreme weather events become more frequent, the impact on both energy security and human rights becomes increasingly palpable. First, let's explore the concept of energy security. For most of us, the flip of a switch or turning the key in our cars is just a routine action. We take it for granted. We can do it with our eyes closed and one hand tied behind our back. But behind this convenience lies a complex network of energy sources, vulnerable to the unpredictable effects of climate change. Fossil fuels, which unfortunately still remains the backbone of our energy infrastructure, contribute significantly to greenhouse gas emissions. And the resulting climate change not only poses physical threats to energy infrastructure, but also creates geopolitical tensions over these dwindling resources. So imagine a world where energy shortages are not just an occasional inconvenience, but a daily struggle for our survival. Vulnerable communities, and more communities are becoming vulnerable, including our own. They're often located in areas prone to climate change disasters. And again, that too is spreading to everywhere. And they find themselves at the forefront of this battle. Access to reliable and affordable energy is crucial for basic needs such as food production, healthcare, and education. And so when climate change disrupts these essential services, it directly infringes upon the human rights of these communities and increasingly infringing upon the human rights of us all. So consider the impact on the right to life itself, which is a fundamental basic human right. As extreme weather events become more frequent and more severe, so do the risk to human life. Heat waves, floods, and hurricanes not only displace communities and individuals, but also lead to increased mortality rates. The nexus between climate change, energy security, and human rights is undeniably intertwined, affecting the most vulnerable among us and increasingly coming for us all. Moreover, the right to a healthy environment, though not explicitly mentioned in many human rights frameworks, is implicitly at stake in the face of climate change. The pollutants released during energy production not only contribute to global warming, but they also contaminate the air and water, directly affecting the health of us all. Those who suffer the most are often those with the least resources to adapt. And that is a great reminder that environmental issues are fundamentally also human rights issues. In recognizing this interplay between energy and climate, we must also acknowledge the power that we as individuals hold in shaping this narrative. Our everyday choices, from the products we buy to the modes of transportation we use, contribute to the overall demand for energy. So by making sustainable choices, we can collectively reduce our carbon footprint and advocate for a shift toward cleaner, renewable energy sources. Now, governments and corporations also play a pivotal role in this narrative. It's imperative for them to prioritize policies that promote sustainable energy practices and to invest in renewable technologies and mitigate the impacts of climate change on all of us. And so as ordinary citizens, we can amplify our voices by supporting and demanding such initiatives. And we're going to talk about this a whole lot more in our discussion with our experts. So the story of energy production and consumption, again, is not just an abstract tale of numbers and statistics. It's a narrative that intimately and directly connects us to the broader challenges of climate change and human rights. And by caring for our planet, we ultimately are caring for ourselves, our health, and the generations to come. So now this is a lot, but here today to help us unpack some of this are some experts who are going to make us smarter. With us today, we have Brenda Brickhouse. Brenda is with the Power Research Institute, and she leads their Equitable Decarbonization Initiative. And Brenda is involved in many research efforts there, including understanding the equity and environmental justice implications and opportunities associated with decarbonization and our transition to clean energy. Prior to joining Power Research Institute, Brenda served as Chief Sustainability Officer at the Tennessee Valley Authority, and she's held a variety of environmental, operational, and leadership roles in the utility industry. Welcome, Brenda, and thank you for joining us. And did I get all of that right?
You did. It's the Electric Power Research Institute. EPRI is what we go by.
Electric Power Research Institute. And it, again, it is a nonprofit. Thank you for that. Our next guest is Luke Metzger. Luke is here with us in Texas. He's in Austin, and he is Executive Director of Environment Texas. Luke is a leading voice in our state for clean air, clean water, clean energy, and open space. And he has led successful campaigns to win permanent protection for the Christmas Mountains of our Big Bend National Park. And he's led campaigns to compel Exxon, Shell, and Chevron Phillips to cut their air pollution at three Texas refineries and chemical plants. And he's led successful campaigns to boost funding for water conservation, renewable energy, and state parks. And Luke is the author or co-author of numerous reports, including Illegal Air Pollution in Texas. Welcome, Luke. You're a busy man, and we appreciate you taking time to join us. And did I get all of that right?
You sure did. Thanks, Bernice, for inviting me to be back on the show.
Thank you.
Looking forward to the conversation.
Thank you, Luke. And our other guest is Jeffrey Rissman. Jeff is the Senior Director of the Industry Program at Energy Innovation. And Energy Innovation is a nonpartisan energy and climate policy think tank. And Jeff's work focuses on technologies and policies to achieve zero net industrial greenhouse gas emissions. Jeff is the author of Zero Carbon Industry, Transformative Technologies and Policies to Achieve Sustainable Prosperity, and he's co-author of Designing Climate Solutions, a Policy Guide for Low Carbon Energy, which was published in 2018, and he is the creator of the Open Source Energy Policy Simulator. Welcome, Jeff, and did I get all of that right?
I'm Bernice. Thank you so much for having me on the show. Yes, all of that's right.
Did your book drop already? I know when we were talking last week, you were expecting it any day.
Yeah, it's available now at bookstores. ZeroCarbonIndustry.com has a link to them, even though the official pub date is February 27th, but stores are selling it already.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. I appreciate it. And again, thank all of you all for joining us. And we just have a few minutes to go before we go to break, but I do want to start with you, Brenda. If you can talk to us, our listeners, briefly, and we'll probably need to continue on the other side, But what is meant by energy security? We hear that word a lot. What is meant by energy security? And then on the other side, we'll talk more about why people should know and care about this.
Yeah, thanks for that question. And so I think about energy security in a number of ways, right? Think about an individual household. Think about their security and the ability to afford their energy bills, their energy burden. Sometimes think about energy poverty for folks who may maintain an unhealthful environment in their homes because they can't afford to fully heat or fully air condition their homes in a healthful way. And so those folks are suffering from energy insecurity. We think about it on the national global scale relative to access to energy, to fuels, and to some of the international conflicts that we've heard. Example would be some of the issues that Europe has had in the wake of the Ukraine war and the access then to natural gas. So I think of energy security in that broad spectrum from the household to the national and global scale.
And I want to go to you for just a few seconds, Luke, before we go to break, in terms of talking a little bit more, too, about energy security and bringing it closer to home so people really understand why to care is not an option. But I am told now that we have to go to break. So, Luke, we will start with you on the other side. Thank you all. We want to give a shout out now to our sponsors. That is Natural Awakenings, Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex Magazine, the Green, Healthy, and Sustainable Living Authority for the DFW Metroplex and North Texas communities. Print issues of Natural Awakenings can be found in all HEB stores, natural grocers, central markets, sunflower shops, and many, many other locations, as well as available free for download online at nadallas.com. Check them out. Our other sponsor is Lynn Dental Care. Practicing dentistry for over 40 years, non-mercury, with a holistic approach, looking at the whole body. Specializing in periodontics, Dr. Lynn is board certified by the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology. Check them out at lynndentalcare.com. Thank you, sponsors. Welcome back to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio. To today's show on energy production and consumption, as we focus in on the nexus of climate change, energy security, and human rights. And we are back with Brenda Brickhouse with the Electric Power Research Institute, with Luke Metzer with Environment Texas, and Jeffrey Rissman at the Energy Innovation Company. Again, thank you all for joining us. And so we want to go back to Luke and resume our conversation about our definitions or making sure people understand what is meant by energy security. So, Luke, as you talk about this, though, can you give some examples where people have really experienced energy insecurity, perhaps on short-term or short-related instances, but also tell us about some potentials so that they can really get what we mean by energy security and how really we're all being impacted by it minute by minute?
Yeah, sure, Bernice. Yeah, I think the best example is of energy insecurity for me is Winter Storm Uri, 3 years ago, where millions of us here in Texas, including my family, lost power for 3 days. And so I think, for me, the core definition of energy security is being, making sure that the power is available when we want it and we need it. We had hundreds of people died in Texas during that storm due in part to power failures. We know that good news is that we've made progress here in Texas in the last few years in strengthening the electric grid so that the chance of a prolonged outage like we saw during Uri is a lot lower. But then the other thing that we've seen is that more and more households are starting to invest in rooftop solar and battery storage so that if there ever is a blackout, that the lights can, and the, more importantly, the heat or air conditioner can stay on during those periods. We've seen particularly a huge uptick in rooftop solar here in Texas in the last several years since Uri. In the last decade, it's been a tenfold increase, the number of people who have chosen to install rooftop solar. So a lot of things that people can do, and particularly with new federal tax credits, 30% off the price of solar and storage, it's increasingly affordable for people.
Indeed. But I want to go back and put a fine point on it, that people know how it feels when we do not have energy. And that's the subject of energy security. Here in Texas with ice storms, and I'm sure every part of the country has had their own issues. I lived in South Florida for 17 years. When a hurricane hits without power for like the longest period was 3 days. And again, I'm sure in every other part of the country, people have experienced some incidences of being without power. That's how it feels. And that's why we talk about, that's why we must be concerned about energy insecurity from when we don't get it. So, you know, thank you all for belaboring with me as I make that point to people as to why this really, really is a big concern. But I want to go back to you for a moment, Luke, and then I want to go over to actually Jeff as well as Brenda, because I want to talk about some ways that people are, we're all exposed to energy security beyond our weather here in Texas or the weather in South Florida or the weather in the Northeast. What are those other ways that could just strike and fall on us any moment? Luke, if you would start that conversation.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think, you know, we know that our electric supply is absolutely vulnerable to extreme weather. And with climate change, we're seeing far greater frequency and severity of extreme weather, whether it's, you know, hurricanes, you know, in hitting the Atlantic or Gulf coasts. People, you know, having to evacuate and then not having, you know, energy because they're, you know, in a shelter perhaps somewhere or living out of their car. And then certainly, yeah, the extreme cold we saw, but also then the extreme heat. We know that, you know, too often many of our power plants are not properly weatherized, or the natural gas supply chain that sends the gas to the power plants is not weatherized, and so quite vulnerable to the, you know, the extreme cold or heat. And so, you know, that's both, you know, in the extreme can mean, you know, hospitalization or even death if people don't have access to power. But also, you know, in my experience during Uri, you know, we went 3 days without power, and thankfully nothing severe, but it was miserable. You know, we had two little girls and trying to keep them warm, you know, huddled in blankets, you know, lighting every candle we could to provide some light and the illusion of heat. And it was a lousy experience. I don't think anyone certainly I don't want to ever experience that again.
And the impact was not evenly distributed. I know people in Austin, all my family's in Austin. I know people in Austin who were without power for up to a week as well. So it was.
And then also, you know, many people lost water, which was, you know, many of the water treatment plants lost power themselves. And so were unable to supply water. And so some people, thankfully we didn't, but some people lost both water and power for a week. And what a disaster that was.
Indeed, indeed. I want to move to you, Jeff, too, if you can talk to us about some potential reasons for concern about energy insecurity out there as well, examples that people may not be aware of or may not have thought of, but daily, right now, it is still perhaps a threat or potential threat to our energy insecurity.
Of course. So energy security is also important for industry and industrial firms, which are the focus of my work. Industrial firms are important employers that provide the economic livelihood for people in their communities. And about half of industrial facilities need to operate 24/7 or choose to, because they want to get the value out of their machinery. They don't want to cool down. Say if they're making steel, they want to keep their furnaces hot. And so having an uninterrupted energy supply is crucial to keep these businesses operating and producing the products we need every day and employing the people that and providing income that impacts everyday families and households. Businesses can be vulnerable also to disruptions in their supply chain. So even if one facility has power, if a supplier that provides them with key materials or parts that they need loses power, then they might, there still might be impacts on that downstream facility if they have trouble getting the parts they need. So energy security is very much important in the industry sector and to the people whose livelihoods are supported by it.
And what you just described, and thank you so much for giving us an example, what you just described really shows us how energy security affects all of us. And many of us would probably not have thought of what you described, but it's reminiscent to me of some of the things that happened in COVID. You know, as you mentioned, about half of the industrial facilities across our country need to go 24/7. If they don't have power, they can't go 0/7. And that then ripples into people's jobs, people not being able to go to work, not making money. So it's rippling through the economy. And depending on how long it's off, it's, you know, our very security. Can we afford to take care of our families by food? The second thing that affects is our stuff that these plants are producing. All of our stuff that we like, food, basics, essentials, that's being disrupted because the plants can't run and people can't go to work. And then even beyond that is the supply chain. You know, are they getting the ingredients, the raw ingredients or the additive ingredients they need to make whatever it is they make? That's like a giant wave. And most of us just don't think about that when we think about energy security. So, but that was the point I want to make. It's just how important that is and how it affects each and every one of us, whether our power goes out or not. So thank you all so much for indulging me as we kind of ferret that out. And so I want to go back now to you, Brenda. How is technology being utilized to address the challenges posed by climate change on our energy security or insecurity?
Yeah, thanks for that. And I also want to appreciate the conversation that happened right before. And to your point about energy insecurity affecting us all, I also want to give a shout out to those folks who are low income and under-resourced. You know, I think, you know, Luke talked about the hardships in his family, and we were without power here from a windstorm a little while ago and lost all the food in the refrigerator. It was fine for us to go to the store and buy all new, but for many families, that's a significant hardship. And so thinking particular about those under-resourced, low-income families and households and communities among us for energy security is an important point. And to segue on that, when you ask about technology, certainly grid modernization is an important piece of that. So thinking about, and I'm going to get a little bit technical here, but there, you know, sensors, automation, you know, ways that the grid can be able to not necessarily require a human or a lineman to come out and put the power back on, but can operate switches remotely, be able to understand who's out, where are folks out, and get the resources and the power back into those areas as quickly as possible. So there's that automation piece that a lot of work is going on in operations research. There's a lot of work going on in engineering research that's being able to support that much more intelligent and faster service restoration. So back to the equity piece of that, right? You know, thinking about not necessarily just the number of people, number of households who are out of power, the amount of load that's out of power. There are certainly critical loads, those industries, hospitals, emergency response centers, evacuation centers, cooling shelters, heating shelters, things like that. But also, all things being equal, we need to think about what sorts of, you know, the demographics of the communities that are out, and how do we prioritize who needs to get power back the quickest?
Yeah, and it does affect the most vulnerable upon us, but I think it's important for everybody to realize it affects them. Probably the response to it affects your low-income and moderate people more, but it's affecting all of us. The power is going, when it's out, you know, it affects all of us. And so it's important that we see this as a collective problem. It's hitting the most vulnerable among us, but we all must care. We're going to go ahead and go to break now, and we will resume this conversation on the other side. And thank you all, guests, with Brenda Brickhouse, Luke Metzger, and Jeffrey Rissman. You are making us smarter. Welcome back to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio. To today's show on energy production and consumption, and we're unpacking the intersection of the impact of climate change on energy security and human rights. And we are back with Brenda Brickhouse with the Electric Power Research Institute, Luke Metzger with Environment Texas, and Jeffrey Rissman with the Energy Innovation Company. And again, thank you all for being with us. I want to move to you now, Luke, because we were kind of talking about this before we went on break, and that is, how can we communicate the urgency of climate change and climate action, specifically as we're talking about energy and energy consumption and production today, but how can we communicate the urgency of that to everyday citizens who might not feel directly involved in environmental issues? Now, we just talked about when the power goes out, and that's one, and to make them realize that's affecting us all and how it could be much worse and much longer, and a lot of different things could impact. But how do we get that across? That really is the purpose for Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio, is to take some of this research and the work that a lot of y'all are doing and try to break it down for them and show them that to care about this stuff is really not an option. It is really an existential necessity.
Yeah, it's a great question, something we grapple with regularly, like how do we communicate? And I think, you know, some people think there's, you know, tons of climate deniers out there, right? And there are some out there, but I think they're louder than the actual representation, you know, of the public. And if somebody's, you know, a hardcore just refusing to accept the science, you're probably not going to convince them. But most of us, you know, are either already accepting the science and concerned about the projections, or on the fence and curious and open to hearing arguments, and those are the people really you want to focus your time with. But I think, you know, talking about the impacts, whether it's power outages or wildfires or extreme heat, the hottest year on record, here in Texas last year, hundreds of people died due to extreme heat. Drought, Texas and many other states around the United States continually are suffering from dwindling water supplies because of climate change induced drought. I think one of the most polling shows us one of the most important things that you can talk about is about the impacts to future generations. We know that, people are concerned about, what kind of planet we're going to leave our kids or our grandkids. And actually, interestingly, talking about that is even more powerful than talking about jobs, according to some polls. And of course, for some people, the jobs in terms of the clean energy opportunities that can provide the economy is also compelling. But talking about, the impacts we're seeing today, and how, the climate is changing and we're observing it, with our very own eyes and feeling it too often. And then talking about, we know that it's only going to get worse unless we reduce pollution. The other thing I think is important to talk about is solutions. If you get too much gloom and doom, people just, throw up their hands and say, what can I do? Why bother? We're screwed. But if you talk about, we're seeing a rapid growth in clean energy, wind and solar power are growing rapidly in terms of percentage of electricity they produce, electric vehicles, more EVs on the road today, and more varieties, the prices have come down dramatically. Talking about these solutions, I think, definitely helped give people hope, and that's really important.
Indeed, and I heard a conversation yesterday, and they were talking about how perhaps the adoption of electric vehicles is being maybe publicly misstated or misinterpreted. And I know that no longer are electric vehicles much, much more expensive than other cars. Fortunately, the price of the other cars has risen to the level of EVs, and now they really are about the same, and maybe even more so when many, many EVs are going so that they can actually power residences. To me, that's that's an additional that hopefully we'll find out or figure out soon how to deduct that basically from the cost of the car in people's mind anyway. So I'm loving it. Thank you for that. Jeff, I want to move to you, though, as we bring up and start talking about the solutions, and that is clean energy and renewable energy. And I know this is your area of expertise, but could you talk to us about what are some of the most promising advancements in renewable energy for industry, And then how can that in turn, perhaps directly or indirectly, benefit individuals and their households in the near future?
Absolutely. So there are many exciting technologies that are enabling a transition to clean industry, which is powered by renewable energy. And I'm happy to highlight some here. And of course, there's more detail in my book, Zero Carbon Industry, than we'd have time for on the show. But there are many that are cost saving. For instance, there are energy efficiency and material efficiency technologies that will allow us to make the products we use and get the services we need from those products while using less energy and less material. And less material means less energy needed to create it. As just one example, today, when you're pouring concrete to make buildings, they typically use these molds made of wooden boards with sharp corners and angles. But those corners tend not to be weight-bearing. They're just there because it's easier to make the shape with a sharp corner. So you can save material if you use a curved fabric mold to shape that building component. That saves material, which saves energy. It makes the building lighter. And it also can make the building more pleasant to use because it's more open and airy. Other technologies allow electrification of industrial process heating. A good example is industrial heat pumps. That's a technology like an air conditioner or a refrigerator in that it moves heat from one place to another. And these industrial heat pumps can achieve output temperatures well above boiling water, 150, 165 Celsius, which is enough to serve about a third of industrial heat demand for things like cooking food and processing textiles and whatnot. And it does so very efficiently, much more efficiently than burning coal or natural gas. So many more technologies I'm happy to discuss or in my book, which you can learn about at zerocarbonindustry.com.
Let me ask you this, Jeff. Are there any estimates or guesstimates of how some of these technologies can trickle down to actually reduce costs for individuals and households or benefit health or other benefits down at the bottom?
Absolutely. So a transition to clean industry will benefit everyone. And I think keeping those co-benefits in mind makes a lot of sense. So Luke already covered the climate change impacts pretty well, like the wildfires and hurricanes and heat waves. So I won't repeat that. But you mentioned health and burning coal and natural gas and other fuels not only generates greenhouse gases, it also generates localized pollutants like particulates, nitrogen oxides, sulfur oxides, which cause heart attacks and lung disease. Thousands of people every year die in the United States from the effects of fossil fuel combustion in industrial facilities. So the transition to clean industry will help mitigate these impacts on communities across the country, which protects their health and, of course, saves money, too, since if you're sick, you have to pay for health care and you can't work or earn money. And then the price of products, too. There are government policies that can help ease this transition and make sure that the impact, it doesn't impact product prices. Heat pumps are a good example where they use electricity so efficiently that you can do so with comparable cost to natural gas, even though per unit of energy, the natural gas is cheaper, but it's used less efficiently. There's also the jobs angle, where a transition to clean industry involves investment in new technologies and workers and investment in our economy, particularly in productive things like industry, generates jobs. And that earns the money that people need to support their families and purchase all of these goods.
Indeed, because there's a lot of noisy conversation out there about clean energy, renewable energy, putting some of the legacy workers out of jobs. But I do know, I don't know the facts of it or the statistics of it, there's new jobs being created. Is there any estimates about that? You know, what's the amount of jobs we're going to lose and then the amount that's going to be created? Because I would also think that clean or renewable energy jobs would be on the higher paying side.
So for the industry sector, I don't have a specific number. In general, industrial facility or a factory using clean processes will still need about as many workers as it does when burning fossil fuels, because you're largely completing many of the same processes, whether that's making cement or electronics or whatnot, and switching the type of energy input, it may change some of the equipment out. You may need technicians to maintain a heat pump instead of an industrial boiler. But on the whole, I do not expect any real job losses in these industries, just a change in the nature of the technologies they'll be using.
Yeah, different types of jobs. And go back to you really quickly, Brenda. We just have 1 minute to go before we, I am told we need to go to break now. When we return from break, we will go back to Brenda to talk a little bit more about innovations in renewable energy. Thank you. We want to give a shout out now to our sponsors. That is Natural Awakenings, Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex Magazine, the Green, Healthy, and Sustainable Living Authority for the DFW Metroplex and North Texas communities. Print issues of Natural Awakenings can be found in all HEB stores, natural grocers, Central Market, Sunflower Shops, and many, many other locations, as well as available free for download online at nadallas.com. Check them out. Our other sponsor is Lynn Dental Care, practicing dentistry for over 40 years with a holistic approach, non-mercury, looking at the whole body. Specializing in periodontics, Dr. Lynn is board certified by the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology. Check them out at LynnDentalCare.com. Thank you, sponsors. Welcome back to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio today and our show on energy production and consumption. And we're looking at the impact of climate change on energy security and human rights. And we are with three experts who are making us smarter. Today we have with us Brenda Brickhouse with the Electric Power Research Institute, Luke Metzger with Environment Texas, and Jeff Risman at the Energy Innovation Institute. Again, thank you all for being with us. I want to go now back to Brenda. If you can talk to us about any innovations, or are there, or what are they, innovations in renewable energy that have the potential to enhance our energy security?
Absolutely. Thanks for that question. I want to start with the basics, right? And we're talking about how ordinary people and individual households can participate in this clean energy transition. And one of the most effective energy technologies is energy efficiency. And so thinking about weatherization, building envelope improvements, as well as electrification to use far less energy in our daily lives than we are currently using. And so that can help both stabilize the system and the grid, right? You know, make us more energy secure because our needs are less, but also improve quality of life for those households and those families to be able to spend less on their energy wallet, as it were. And so then scaling up from there, right, thinking about, we've talked about solar, we've talked about wind, batteries, all kinds of technologies that are improving every day. And also the integration of those technologies, which tend to be intermittent, right, you know, the sun shines and the wind blows. Battery storage can moderate and mitigate that, as well as thinking about those, as I call them, the widgets that manage the flow of electricity across the system. As those are becoming more intelligent, they're becoming more, you know, using AI, artificial intelligence, to be able to predict and plan and manage throughout the day as people's needs come and go and change. All of those innovations are happening at a very rapid rate, and really exciting to be able to think about managing with far fewer fossil fueled resources, far more clean energy, low to no carbon resources. That's a big shift for the grid as a whole. And so managing the grid with those new resources coming online is an important piece to think about as well. So everything from household energy industry, household energy and efficiency, as well as grid operations, bringing these new devices online.
And I want to move to Luke now. Luke, what role does urban planning, city planning, and development codes and things of that nature, what role do they play in helping us create sustainable, energy-secure cities and areas?
Yeah, Bernice, they play a huge role. You know, we know that today transportation is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States, more than electricity. And that means that the way we build our cities and how much people need to drive their cars, you know, has a big impact on our climate. And so the more that we're able to build walkable, bikeable, transit-friendly, you know, communities, that means people have options that they don't necessarily need to drive all the time. You know, they may choose to, you know, take one of these other transportation modes themselves, and that can have a huge impact. We also know that the denser the community, the less greenhouse gas emissions they use and less energy they use than, say, just a sprawling kind of single-family neighborhoods. Generally, are going to use, you know, more electricity, use more water, and have other impacts. So, to the extent that communities are, you know, increasingly allowing things like, you know, row houses and, you know, duplexes and garage apartments and other kinds of housing options in the urban core, that I think is one of the best things cities can do to have an impact on climates and just build a more sustainable community.
And there are two things that have been around for a while that I want to ask about, because it seems this to me, if these were followed up, they could make a big impact. And one is maybe some type of zoning or entitlements or codes or something that would encourage or not encourage, incentivize building the house with solar panels. And I know that there is a builder out of Austin who does that. They've done some units here in Dallas too. But if there was policy or some codes in effect to incentivize that, I have to think it would go a long way. Do you know of anybody who's using something like that, or any conversations to push that forward or that are out there, Luke?
Yeah, well, I know that, you know, some states like California are requiring kind of new homes to have solar, and then other states, you know, have incentive programs, you know, because that's particularly when you're building a new home and you're already doing all the wiring for everything else the house needs, it's a perfect time to install solar. You reduce the cost of insulation if you install it when you're building the house in the first place. And so I think, you know, there are, you know, utilities that have incentive programs. I mentioned earlier, there's the new federal tax credits or the renewed federal tax credit, 30% off the price of solar, which in itself has also dropped significantly over the last decade. As more and more people are opting for solar, we're building the economies of scale that have helped reduce the price. I think, you know, either through requirements or through incentives, you know, making sure that the buildings that we build are as efficient as possible, using, you know, insulation and efficient appliances, and then, you know, installing solar is a big step we could take.
Indeed. And I put this out to everyone if anybody has any particular knowledge of it. But I know a number of years back when I was working on some national issues around transportation efficient mortgages. And then I had heard some conversation about energy efficient mortgages. And this is where they kind of roll in the cost of having a number of energy efficient mechanisms within the home that the mortgage is going to be on. And they translate that down to a lower mortgage. Does anybody know about any conversations or work that may be being done in that area?
Well, I can just, I can't speak much to it, but I think, it's a really smart tool, right? Because one of the big barriers that we have is the big upfront cost of solar panels or, you know, more efficient windows and so on. And so if we can actually roll that into the mortgage, we know that any additional price that you pay in your monthly mortgage payment is often lower than the energy savings that you get. And so you are, as a result, able to save money immediately. And so for many people, or most of us who don't have, you know, thousands of dollars in savings that they can just, you know, pay in cash for some of these improvements, you know, rolling it into the mortgage, or, you know, some utilities have what's called on-bill financing, right, where you basically get a loan from the utility and then you pay it back on your utility bill. But the net is such that you're saving money immediately. Those kinds of innovative financing strategies, I think, are really critical towards fueling the energy transition.
Yeah, and they'd make a big difference. And I would like to, at some point, see if any of those things are being used globally so that we can really see what's going on. I want to jump to Brenda for a minute. Brenda, how does climate change impact national security? And what are some of the implications for energy security at that broader level?
Yeah, one of the things that we're working on at EPRI is an initiative called Climate Ready, and it's READI, so it's the Resilience and Adaptation Initiative. And so we're taking a look from that national, if not bigger, right, you know, the global climate, looking at climate data. How do we understand what's happening to the right to climate change, extreme weather, storms, you know, floods, wildfires, all of that. So thinking about those impacts and being able to scale those down to more regional and local levels so that we can plan much better for the system, so that we can plan grid hardening, you know, things to do with the power lines and with the power plants to be able to for them to withstand the extreme temperatures or the extreme weather that they might experience. So that predictive capability is something that we're taking a good hard look at. And then looking at the assets themselves, right? I mentioned it to the power lines, to the power plants, to the solar panels, to whatever those technologies and installations and infrastructure look like. How do we understand what climate change is happening to those particular assets? And then how are they vulnerable? And then how can we mitigate and manage those impacts coming on? So with the changes, you guys mentioned the winter storm Uri and some of the plants and other facilities may not have been designed for the extreme cold temperatures that they experienced. And so being able to understand much better what those climate impacts are likely to be and what those particular vulnerabilities are at different aspects and points in the system, that's something that we can do, like I said, at the national scale, but really coming down as well into that regional and local scale to be able to improve energy security for everyone.
Indeed. And the operative word that you mentioned is predictive. We can do some of that now. We can predict that in any given season, some area of our country is going to have a weather issue that's going to affect power for sure. And we just have 1 minute to go, and I want to give one half of a second to you, Luke. What is perhaps maybe a very powerful or positive example of communities themselves making a difference in mitigating climate change that you can tell us about in half a minute?
Yeah, well, one good example is the city of Houston is taking an old landfill and building a community solar farm on top of it, you know, in an area of predominantly low-income African-American community. Instead of this giant, horrible landfill, have a community solar farm. City of Austin has committed to all-electric school buses. And that's exciting both because it'll mean fewer greenhouse gas emissions, less diesel exhaust for the kids, but also an energy source. You know, we can use those electric buses as rolling batteries during blackouts, hurricanes, to power operations. You know, one single bus could power 5 operating rooms for 8 hours. So a lot of great
stuff. I love that. We need to hear much more about that. And again, thank you all so much. You've really, I think, moved the ball forward in helping just ordinary citizens in their everyday lives understand our state of energy security or energy insecurity. We have been with Brenda Brickhouse with Electric Power Research Institute, Luke Metzger with Environment Texas, and Jeffrey Rissman at Energy Innovation. Thank you all. And we want to thank you, listeners, for listening in to Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio today. The conversation starts here, but our goal is for it to continue in your home, in your social circles, your workplaces, at the water cooler, and even in the grocery checkout line, so that we can all work together to realize that healthy living is simply not possible without a healthy planet. Our culture is a result of a trillion tiny acts taken by billions of people every day like yourselves. And each of those tiny acts can seem insignificant, but all of them add up one way or the other to the change that we each live through. This is your host, Bernice Butler. Thank you for listening in today. And join us for more Healthy Living, Healthy Planet Radio. And listen to any of our past shows on podcast wherever you get yours. Thank you.